Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to the Third Coast Podcast. I'm Katie Mingle. You'll hear our weekly radio show, Resound, here, as well as the occasional story curated recently from our audio library at thirdcoastfestival.org. The Third Coast Festival is a nonprofit organization whose livelihood depends in part on support from listeners like you. To find out how you can help or to check out all of the cool stuff we do apart from our radio show, visit our website, thirdcoastfestival.org. Thanks, and enjoy the podcast.
My name is Hakeem Shahi. My prison number was 10199050. I was a federal prisoner from 1989 to 2006.
From the Third Coast International Audio Festival in Chicago, I'm Gwen Maxey, and this is Resound.
Nine cells, nine bodies, nine stories. Who are these people?
Resound is a remix of music, documentaries, found sound, sound bites, and sonic gems we find all over the world. On the air, on the web, on the job, we listen to everything we can get our ears on and bring you the best of what we hear.
Who are these people?
Yo, man, where'd you get that, man? Make me something.
When you see it, you go, wow.
Somehow, in solitary confinement, he managed to create a kitchen, and he made pralines.
And he said, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry. I said, I know.
Forgiveness is a pretty big word. I don't think I expect her to forgive me.
I said, I have a few questions that I've been waiting almost 30 years to ask you, but I need to have them answered.
Today on Resound, we explore some big ideas, justice, injustice, punishment, and redemption, through small, powerful, personal stories. Stay with us. Back when Ray Matterson had a coke habit, he tried to rob a store with a toy gun. He was caught and sentenced to 7.5 years in prison. 1 year into his sentence, he unexpectedly found redemption in a needle, but not the kind you might imagine.
There were commercials coming on for all the upcoming bowl games. It was Christmas season, 1988, and Michigan was slated to play the University of Southern California in the Rose Bowl. The man a couple of cells down from me was hanging out some underwear and socks to dry on the tier railings, and among his underwear and socks were a pair of tube socks with yellow and blue stripes, which are University of Michigan colors. And I thought to myself, I gotta have those socks. So I struck up a deal and I bought the socks for a pack of cigarettes, which was kind of the going rate. And I pulled the socks, the thread out of these socks, and I borrowed a sewing needle from the guard. And I designed a sewing hoop out of a Rubbermaid dish, tore a piece of sheet from my bunk, drew a block letter M, and I embroidered this maize and blue letter M, which I then sewed onto a little makeshift hat that I made. And my plan was to watch the Rose Bowl game and get some popcorn and Kool-Aid from the prison store and pretend as though I were in Pasadena. What happened, though, as soon as I started sporting my strange little Michigan hat around the cell block, yo, man, where'd you get that, man? Make me something. I was almost immediately inundated with requests for all variety of flags and sports emblems. Listen, man, I really want you to make me a such and such. And I'd say, well, I'd really like to make you a Seattle Seahawks emblem, but I don't have any Seahawk green. And then the next day, sort of mysteriously on the bunk, Seahawk green socks would show up. The pieces just, and they started, they were involving myself and my own experience more and more into the pieces. I started designing images from my own life experience, you know, home life problems, my drug and alcohol abuse. Where's Madison? Now he's up on his bunk sewing. Sports heroes, theater scenes, songs and peaceful thoughts a lot of times. I escaped into the artwork.
When you see it, you go, wow. And then you look closer under a magnifying glass and you say, wow again. I mean, we're talking a work that's maybe 2.5 inches wide by 2.5 inches tall.
2.25 by 2.75 inches.
I think all his works are that small.
Once I was paroled, that was sort of my job.
I've seen all different kinds of work that Ray did. At the show last week, he had done one called Metamorphosis, which was like a butterfly.
A monarch butterfly.
Escaping from the cocoon.
Emerging from the chrysalis. I still continue to take the socks apart. The taking apart of the socks is sort of what happened in my life, because my life went from one thing, going into the, you know, into the unknown, into the dark, into the, it came apart. It was suspended animation, sort of, and then it was turned back into something emerging from the chrysalis, much more special than it had been.
That was Embroidery Felon by Jonathan Mitchell. Jonathan's beautifully produced podcast, The Truth, features what he calls movies for your ears. Intrigued? Find out more at our website, thirdcoastfestival.org. Our next story probes the limits of confession and forgiveness. Margot Van Slytman's father was killed when she was a young girl. Almost 30 years later, the murderer wrote her a letter to apologize. Was that acceptable? Was that enough? Margot and the murderer she would come to know tell the story.
It was great growing up in Toronto. We came to Canada in 1969, just before I turned 8 years old. And it was astounding. You know, we got here October 25th, the day before my father's birthday. But I think about a week or two after that, after we got here, there was snow. And we had never seen snow in our born days.
I was brought up in Oak Bay, which is a sort of upper middle class neighborhood. So I had a fairly comfortable youth. My parents didn't drink or they didn't abuse me in any way. They loved me very much, actually.
My dad, oh my God, he grew up in an area in Guyana, very handsome, very fun-loving, the best teeth in the world.
I was a great kid at home. I didn't do very well at school. I rebelled against the school system quite a bit and got a lot of trouble at school, but my parents would think I was a perfect little kid right at home. I did what I was supposed to do and did my chores and behaved myself pretty well at home, but when I got out the door, I was a different person.
He was the first one in our family to try water skiing. A brilliant dancer, like my mom. My mom still dances like a mad woman. He loved us very, very much. He loved his children very much.
First contact I ever had with the law was about 7 years old. I was with my brother. He was 2 years older than me. He and my cousin had a skeleton key. In the old days, the locks weren't too good. They were going around and going into people's houses. We were doing something wrong. And then the next contact I had with the police in a serious way was probably when I was 11, busted for shoplifting. And I kind of started to hate them. And I went down the road of kind of seeing myself at war with the police. And so I started stealing, and it continued to escalate, actually.
Well, this is what happened. We did have a fairly idyllic life. And on March 27th, an Easter Monday in 1978, my dad went into his place of employment, which was the Hudson's Bay Company, and he was only to be gone for 2 hours. I was supposed to go with him, and he said, "No, you little pest, I'm only going to be gone 2 hours. I'll be right back home."
I'd been in jail quite a few times by that time and had teamed up with a couple of guys that were pulling holdups. And we had ended up in Toronto and had decided we were going to start robbing Brink's trucks. So we had this one place that we thought would look pretty easy that we'd start off with, Angleton Mall in Scarborough. So you go and look at the place, you find out the routine of the guards when the money comes, you know. But this place, there was only one guard that came, picked up the money. He left the truck and went and got the money and then came back. So it looked fairly simple to take that one person out and take his money. But it did go terribly wrong.
We used to hang up clothes downstairs on the line. My dad's clothes were there. And then I looked around, I ran upstairs, there was my mom sitting on the steps, all of 36 years old at that time, and my little brother and little sister were just hugging her, and she looked at me and said, "Margot, Daddy dead."
We actually committed the robbery, but as we were leaving the store, Mr. Van Slaven, who was there on his day off, actually, as I understand, he had tried to stop us from leaving. I didn't see him actually. He was behind a clothes rack or something. It was a higher clothes rack, and he wasn't a really tall man. We were running away from the crowd, kind of, and people were saying, "Stop those guys!" And the next thing I know, Mr. Van Slaven stepped out and grabbed me by the lapels and told me to stop.
We didn't think very much about the man who did this to my father. There was nothing to think about. Except, what are we going to do without Dad, without Theodore? We didn't follow the trial because it was irrelevant. It didn't matter. He was gone. He was gone.
My partner, the guy that was with me, and I shot him. I don't know. I remember his face. I don't think he understood that we had guns. You know, he said to me, "Just give it up, son." The guy that was behind me, I guess, or behind him, shot him first. I heard a shot rang out, and I just pulled the trigger. And then he fell down. Yes, I remember that. I remember that.
Was there anger? Deep, deep anger that couldn't even fit into your body? Oh, yeah. But vengeance is... it didn't fit.
You know, I think I dreaded that he was dead, yeah. As soon as we got home, we turned on the news. It was about, I think, 2.5 months before we were actually arrested for that robbery and murder. The only way to live with that, to change my life, I had to get to a point where I could look myself in the mirror and say, you know, at least I tried the hardest I could today, and it's because I owe it to Mr. Van Slaven to do that. He had 4 children. He had 3 daughters and a son. Yes, I did think about them. I had 2 twin sons who I was allowed to have what they call private family visits, which is 72 hours. They come over and spend time with you. And, you know, I'd sit there at nighttime. I couldn't sleep. I'd think about, you know, what it must be for his family to, I was so lucky to be able to sit there, lie there, and watch them breathe as they went to sleep. And, they were just little kids, 8, 9 years old, and I just thought about how his family must have been affected by that. At least I could hold them now, and I'd taken that away from him and his family.
I'm sitting there at my computer one day, and I get an email. An email comes in, and I recognize the last name, and honest to God, is this who I think this is? Why is this person contacting me? I need a couple of questions answered. I need dialogue. 29.5 years.
We thought we were doing it anonymously, actually. We did it where she didn't think she was going to realize it was me.
This is what I did. My daughter, Jessie, was watching television in the room with me, and I said to her, Jess, I think I just received an email from the wife of the man that murdered Grandpa Theodore. And I said, I think I'm going to email these people, you know. I said, I think that, you know, some of our family members will be very angry with me. I said, but I need to know. I'm going to do it.
And she asked if I would write a letter, if I was wanted to apologize or anything. So I sent her off an email, basically, that said that I was very sorry and that I, well, what can you say? I want you to know that I think about her. I think about them every day. So many things happened that would make me ponder the fact that I was alive and their father was dead.
I went to bed, and in the morning I woke up to an apology, a short, very potent paragraph from Glenn apologizing for murdering my father. I read it, and I cried, and I cried, and basically I thanked him. I emailed him, and I said, thank you. And I feel I am finally able to free my poor dad, who I've been carrying around with me for so damn long.
The very first time we ever met was an incredible moment.
I did meet the man who murdered my father. I asked for that. What I thought is, in an email, in a letter, you can say whatever you want. But unless you see someone's face, you don't know if it's authentic or not.
It was more than I expected, actually. I dreamt about things like that, but, you know, you have dreams that you know are never going to come true, and I certainly had accepted the fact that probably those people would never want to hear from me. When I first got out, very first thing I did when I got out, I went back to Toronto, visited Mr. Van Sleeman and his grave. And you could see from the grave that he was very well thought of. There was flowers there. And I never thought I'd actually meet his family. I could understand the disdain they'd have for me. She wanted to come and meet me, so we...
So we met at Westminster Abbey in B.C., and I see this man dressed in black, wearing a black fedora, some bling on him. I was sitting there and I'm thinking, all right, Dad, here we go, kid. And I just walked up. So I looked at him, I said, you must be John Glendon Flett. He said, yes. I said, well, I am Margot Van Sleitman. And we looked at each other. I just hugged him. He hugged me and we started to cry and cry and cry. And he said, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I said, I know. I said, I have a few questions that I've been waiting almost 30 years to ask you, and I need to have them answered.
She wanted to know what had happened, all the details of that day. She was willing to listen. It was incredibly humbling.
And so I said, all right, you are the last human being to have seen Theodore Van Sleitman, my dad, alive. I want to know exactly what happened. Demonstrate exactly what happened. Oh yeah, and he did. And I must tell you, I was not a wreck. Like, I wasn't falling down weeping. It was not about bravado. I'm just looking at this human being, and to be honest with you, if I were him, I would have jumped in that fountain and drowned myself. Because I can imagine that reliving that is not a joke. He was going into a very, 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 very dark place.
Forgiveness is a pretty big word. I don't think I expect her to forgive me. I don't know if I forgive myself even, so I'm a Christian and I believe God forgives me, but I work at that concept of forgiveness. I don't know if that's something that I think is possible after a terrible thing like that.
I'm looking at this person, like the first time I saw him, I couldn't take my eyes off him. Like, I couldn't. But I'm trying to imagine what it was like standing there in front of that man, Theodore Everestus Van Sleitman, 40 years old, making a choice that would change the face of many, many, many people, the lives of many people. I kept looking at him thinking he saw Daddy last. And now he's looking at Theodore's daughter. What does that feel like?
I do think that there's a possibility of connection with people after you've done them harm. But forgiveness, I don't know. I'm not sure what that exactly would look like.
Indirectly, I told my mom that I was going to meet with Glenn. And then I said to her, I said, well, I have to tell you this. I have worked in prisons a few times. And then I said, and there's something else, Mum. She says, you've met him? And she said, Margot, why would you do that? I said, I need to. I said, he told me he's sorry and I believe him, Mum, but I need to see him, you know? So my mum said to me, she said, but what if he's not telling the truth, Margot? What if he's lying? I said, Mum, then he has two crosses to bear. I believe that what he has to live with is much more, shall I say, demanding than what I have to live with. And I couldn't imagine it. I couldn't imagine it. He has to live with that. Yes, I do. I have compassion and sympathy for that. The depth of pain and guilt that he has felt is equal to mine, and both of them show the depth of love and compassion that we can also have. I know he knows that. I think that my dad is celebrating. That's how I feel. And the first time Glenn and I sat down and had a meal together, I looked at him. I said, my dad would have liked you.
In those days, I don't think he would have liked me. Maybe today, I'm maybe more likable. But when I killed him, I certainly wasn't a very likable person then. It's for her. This is more than I ever could have expected, and I think I'd resolved my issues as much as they can be resolved. You know, this won't be over until I'm dead.
Forgiveness was produced by Michael O'Halloran and Margot Van Sleitman with Neil Sandel for Outfront, a show on the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. Outfront was canceled, but for over a decade they helped ordinary Canadians tell their extraordinary personal stories on the radio. To hear more from our friendly neighbors to the north, visit thirdcoastfestival.org.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
You're listening to ReSound from the Third Coast International Audio Festival in Chicago. I'm Gwen Maxey. Support for ReSound comes from the Evanston Athletic Club, supporting fitness and health for the entire community since 1980. More information on the Evanston Athletic Club services is available at chicagoathleticclubs.com. Support also comes from Art Factory Screen Printing, producing screen-printed and embroidered apparel for businesses, organizations, schools, and events in Chicago. Information on quotes and image galleries are available at artfactorytees.com. In a little while, we'll bring you the story of a man who made prison life a tiny bit sweeter by making candy. But first, we visit a place within prison rarely talked about, solitary confinement. Producer Claire Schoen spoke to 9 survivors of solitary, one of whom was there for almost 30 years, and brings us their stories.
President Obama recently declared, "We have banned torture without exception." However, some would take exception to this claim.
The hole.
We called it the hole.
The hole.
The hole.
The hole. That's what prisoners call it, among other things.
The bucket, the can.
The box, the hole, the bin.
The chiller.
Lockup.
Maxi.
The shoe.
Solitary confinement.
Solitary confinement. One person, one cell.
The cell that I lived in most of the time was 6 feet wide and about 9 feet long.
The cell was probably like maybe 7 feet, maybe 9 feet long.
Maybe 9 by 6.
5 by 9.
five
maybe
by nine.
Maybe a 10 by whatever.
It was big enough for me to lay down, and I'm 6'3".
It's very small.
These men and women are survivors. That's the term for prisoners who have survived solitary confinement, because the hole is something which must be survived, if you're lucky.
Lockdown, total lockdown. The best way I can describe it is this. The cell was a windowless cell.
And you had a bar door and an outer solid door closed over you.
The door was a double lock slide door.
The walls were cinder block.
Cement, like a slab for us to sleep in.
The bed is a 4-inch slab of concrete.
The bed is concrete. There's a small concrete slab that serves as your table.
And the floor, it was concrete.
There was a sink with no stopper and a toilet.
There's a combination toilet and sink that's stainless steel, no seat, you know.
Everything is concrete and steel.
Metal and cement.
That was it.
No two stories that I heard were exactly alike, but a picture of the experience of solitary confinement was emerging.
The light.
I did not have control over the light switch.
Why double neon light?
It was usually on, and it was very difficult to get it turned off at night.
There's one light that comes in from the outside that's on all the time.
There's lights on most of the night.
The light would be on sometime 24/7. It never went out.
People are in situations where they have the lights on 24 hours a day. And the situation I was in, the lights were out 24 hours a day. They never turned the lights on.
You're in the dark for like extended period of time.
It was dark all the time.
It's been too much light, which can be blinding, and it was too much darkness, which is also blinding. It's been both at times.
Solitary confinement is about sensory deprivation.
The boxcar cell is designed for sensory deprivation because the cell itself is recessed. It sits in, and there's bars on the front of it, but then you have what's called a trap or a dead space, and then you have another solid door and wall. You cannot stand up to the bars and see a little bit down to the left or a little bit down to the right.
There was a big door that closed, and you didn't hear anything outside of the door.
And the first night that I was there, I thought, it's so quiet. But very quickly, the quiet becomes oppressive.
It can get eerily quiet in these places.
Real quiet.
Mostly what you're going to hear is your own breathing, you know? You might hear your heart rate pumping up.
You could hear bugs.
What you hear is nothing. You know, there is no sound to hear.
Sensory deprivation. But it's also about overwhelming the senses.
When there is a noise, like a steel gate opening because the guards are going to come down to tier, it's just nerve-wracking to hear that noise.
Coming onto the tier, it's a heavy steel door, and it opens electrically, which means you hear... They step in, and they just let it slam shut. All right? They walk down the tier, they got combat boots on.
Boots hitting concrete. And all the guards carry clubs.
Banging the batons or whatever it is they have, the nightsticks, against the wall.
You hear a lot of banging. Mental ill guys do this banging.
Screaming and yelling, crying, cops threatening, constant threats.
There were times when it got close to being so loud it was intolerable.
A crying baby, or the leaves of a tree fluttering in the wind. You don't hear any of these sounds at all.
Sometimes you welcome the noise. You wanted to hear somebody, regardless of what noise they made.
I really wanted to talk to somebody, you know, just somebody to be there.
You can go days without talking to people, sometimes weeks, sometimes months.
You can't touch anyone, you can't hear anybody speak.
There was no touch, there was no human touch.
No human touch.
Except for aggressive touching by guards when they would come in to chain me up to take me out.
No human touch.
You have no contact with guards. unless you are handcuffed and shackled.
Human touch. Or human pat touch. Search me, which they would do, although I was only in that cell, so what could I have?
Touch. I did not touch anyone for years. Touch.
It's all. It's just all in your head.
For years. For years.
Well, you can touch the cement. That's about it.
The hole affects one's sense of touch, sight, sound, even smell.
It's a dusty smell. Smell like concrete.
Or steel, I think maybe some rust.
Stale, musty air.
You know the smell of rust?
That was it.
Steel.
Metal cement.
That was it.
9 cells, 9 bodies, 9 stories. Who are these people? Americans are imprisoned for everything from drugs or theft to possession of weapons and robbery to assault and murder. And some are innocent. 2 of these 9 former prisoners had their convictions overturned after decades in prison.
My name is Hakeem Shahi. My prison number was 10199050. I was a federal prisoner from 1989 to 2006.
My name is Laura Whitehorn, and I'm from New York City. I did a little more than 14 years. I was a federal prisoner.
My name is Robert DeLello. I'm from Massachusetts. I'm 66 years old. I just completed a 40-year sentence that I overturned. Well, I hit most all the reform schools. I hit the Concord Prison and Walpole State Prison. I've been to Marion, Illinois twice. I've been in Lewisburg, Pennsylvania.
My name is Bilal Suni Ali. I'm originally from Harlem, New York. I'll be 60 years old in July. I was in prison for 5 years totally, if we count it all up.
Manera El Bumani from Newark, New Jersey. I was in prison for 4 years in the Edna Mayhem Correctional Facility in Northern State Prison.
Ray Luke Levasseur was born and raised in Maine, left for many decades, returned in 2004 when I got out of prison. I was in prison 20 years, including the notorious federal prison at Marion, which is the prison that replaced Alcatraz. And then when ADX Administrative Maximum was built, I was sent to ADX.
I'm Tommy Escarcega. I'm originally from El Paso, Texas. I was in a jail that was called Civil Brand Institute for Women.
Dino King Archangel Rodriguez, a member of the Almighty Land Kings and Queens Nation in New Jersey State. I've been in the pen as an adult, 12 and a half years. Northern State Prison, Yardville Correctional, Bordentown Correctional, Trenton.
Concord Prison in
Southwoods,
Marion,
Lewisburg,
ADX.
And as a juvenile, probably around 26 institutions.
Robert King Wilkerson, Angola State Prison, Louisiana. It's a maximum security prison. It covers 18,000 acres. It gets its name from the country, Angola, Africa, because it's alleged that a lot of the slaves coming from Angola were habitated at that plantation.
All of these prisons have solitary confinement cells. The use of solitary is widespread in the U.S. and growing. Tens of thousands of inmates are locked in solitary today. In fact, there are now more than 30 supermax prisons where every inmate in the entire institution is in solitary confinement.
They come up with fancy names. You have SHU. SHU is the special housing unit.
It was also called administrative segregation. That's a nice, polite term for it.
CCR, and it means closed cell restricted.
Time out, that's a little euphemism.
Another name for solitary confinement is el hoyo, which means the hole.
We called it the hole.
Prison itself is hard and dangerous, but some would argue that it is a fair price to pay for criminal actions against society. However, being put in solitary confinement has nothing to do with what you did on the outside, why you were arrested, tried, convicted. In fact, prisoners are not sentenced to solitary by a judge or in a court of law at all. It's a decision that happens once you're inside. It's made by a prison warden or a prison board at their discretion. and with very little oversight.
I was placed in lockup because of my membership in the Almighty Latin Kings and Queens Nation. That's labeled a gang, but now gangs are labeled security threat group units. That's the name they use now. Then any member of a security threat group, they'll put you in a control unit, which is a hole.
They placed me in solitary because I was a member of the Black Panther Party. That was their reason, but I think they ran out of reason after a couple of years.
The hole is supposed to be used for the protection of the prisoner or those around him, but it isn't always the most violent who are sent there. Instead, it's those who are seen as troublemakers. It's used as punishment for those who will not, or in some cases cannot, obey the rules. The mentally ill end up in solitary. So do the organizers.
It's not always for safety. If you are a leader of any group, or if you are influential of a group of inmates, then they can use that to lock you down.
I was organizing the women in Civil Brand because the deputies there were turning on the heat in the summer and the fan in the winter. So being that I had not ever been to prison before, I said, they can't do this. And, you know, all the rest of the prisoners are looking at me like, yes, they can. No, we have to organize and all that. And so they came for me.
The last 10 years of my incarceration was spent in Marion Federal Prison, which everyone knows is a supermax lockdown, 23-1. I was sent there for giving a speech to the NAACP. The prison officials at the United States Penitentiary in Terre Haute claimed that the speech that I gave them was inflammatory. The speech was only telling the NAACP visitors at the prison that there was a lot of racism going on in the prison amongst the guards, and there was unneeded and unjustified touching from the guards on prisoners. They felt that it was an embarrassment. So they decided that it was time to teach me a lesson. These are their words now, to teach me a lesson. Now, I was supposed to be sent there for 18 months. However, I spent 10 years there.
Of course, they say they intended to, you know, to reform, but they're designed to punish because all the reform was taken out of prison, the so-called, quote, reform.
There are also the stories about physical abuse, beatings and assault by guards. They're upsetting, though not unexpected, because we hear those stories. But the idea of solitary confinement, the conscious act of separating a human being from everything that allows us to be human, that's something we don't hear about.
You had nothing in the room but you.
Just your lonely body in a cell that's empty.
It's hard to describe nothing.
Emptiness. That's what solitary confinement is. No other way to describe it.
And you were confined to a cell 23 hours a day?
23 hours in lockup.
I was there 24 hours a day.
When prisoners are allowed an hour of exercise, they're still often kept in isolation.
You got recreation sometimes. They'll determine whether you should get rec, whether they want to give you rec. Nothing's guaranteed in a control unit.
Nothing's guaranteed. Decisions about every minute aspect of daily life seem random and arbitrary.
No matter what a book says, if a book says you're entitled to a pencil, you're not going to get a pencil.
Food that was supposed to be hot would be served cold. Food that was supposed to be served cold would be served hot.
It's little microaggressions.
I've been in holes where they control the toilet flush from the outside.
It was like their form of punishment.
Coming and going. I got to be strip searched. Bare ass naked, you know, and it's a full, you know, cavity search and the whole thing.
The main thing was not so much each condition, because those changed sometimes. The main thing was the message, you have no control. You are at our mercy.
I felt very vulnerable, very scared.
You try to do everything you can to please the prison officials to get out of that situation. Everything you could possibly do, and there's not much you could do.
The key is in the hand of a prison guard who may or may not follow the orders of the board that put you in isolation.
And you had no recourse.
Or the people who sentenced you to isolation may tell them, don't let him out when his time is up.
And that was the thing, I think, that made me the most depressed, was knowing that there were rules that they were supposed to adhere to, and knowing that they weren't, and knowing that there were no penalties, that no one was holding them accountable.
I've spent 7.5 years in the control unit.
Maybe about 12 years in lockdown.
I was there for 29 years, you know, solitary confinement.
Many, many years in solitary confinement.
29 years, you know, 29 years, 29 years, you know.
29 years in solitary. How could this be happening here? This is not Guantanamo or Abu Ghraib. This is Kentucky, Louisiana, California, New York. Every state in America uses solitary confinement.
Solitary confinement is just as real could be. It plays on you big time, and it could wipe the mind.
What does it do to a person to be locked up in a 9x6 room for weeks, months, years, alone?
A life like that, it damaged you psychologically, you know, because human beings need to interact with each other.
It's not normal to be in the dark for days and days and days on end.
It strips you of a lot of things.
It mixes you up.
I could hardly sleep, like I had insomnia.
Waking up at night in the sweats, panic attacks.
I would have a panic attack, and I would bang on the wall.
It would trigger something in my nerves where I would break out in hives from head to toe. It would happen 3 or 4 times a day.
Your senses is so sharp, you can actually hear a mouse walking on the floor.
I lost track of time.
They took my watch, and I was not permitted to know what time it was.
There's no concept of time. You know no time in lockdown. There's sleep and awakeness. That's it. And the madness in between all that.
The madness in between all that. The hate and the anger take such control of you. Your rational thinking goes out the window.
I felt angry. I felt so angry at times that I couldn't focus on anything else.
I mean, horrific thoughts are playing in your mind.
It made me develop hatred.
Are playing in your mind.
The anger builds up and the frustration builds up.
I cried a lot. I cried quietly. I cried loudly.
The anger, the rage, the bitterness, the anxiety, the nightmares, and as years passed, you know, it's, you know, 1 year passed, 2 years passed, 3 years passed, it just seemed like the walls in the cell began to close in. You could feel your mind like trying to escape from you, and you begin to wonder, well, what's going on with you?
I distrusted a lot of my own perceptions.
Begin to hear voices, begin to see things.
You see sort of like something moved in your cell, that like there was somebody there.
And you never knew what it was.
And there's nobody there, you know?
I would try to hear things, try to hear human voices. And sometimes I would imagine that I was hearing noises.
You hear noise, and it sounds like somebody said something there.
You start hearing things that's not even being said.
And say, yeah, you know, yeah, what? And nobody's answering you.
And you wonder, what are they whispering about doing something to you? What are they even saying you going crazy? Paranoia sets in so deep, it just begins to collapse in on you.
And what happens is chaos.
Insanity.
The hole drives people insane. And those who go in with emotional problems come out far, far worse. Psychiatrists describe a syndrome seen in people who've experienced sensory deprivation. POWs, hospital patients in full body cast, prisoners in the hole. The effects include insomnia, paranoia, rage, time distortion, depression, despair, claustrophobia, hallucination, and more.
They'll say the end of the barrel. That's what the prison officials call it, the end of the barrel.
Control units.
Controlled movement.
Call it maximum security, administrative segregation.
Or disciplinary transfer.
Stigma unit. Seg.
Isolation.
D-D-O.
You know, on and on and on and on and on.
So many of them.
I will say torture chambers. No other way to describe them.
Solitary confinement is torture.
It is torture, 100%.
Of course it's torture. It's torture in every form of fashion.
The United Nations Human Rights Committee says that prolonged solitary confinement is torture.
I believe that putting human beings in total isolation is torture.
The cell itself is designed to severely limit your senses.
Human beings are social beings, and to remove not only human contact, but any kind of color, tactile.
The concrete, the bars, the wall.
Sensory deprivation. That's torture.
How do they expect you to maintain your humanity when everything you see, everything you touch, is just so hard?
The effects of solitary don't end at the prison gates. More than 95% of prisoners are released at some point, and many are released directly from solitary confinement into the streets.
When I first got out, I was really psychotic, hearing voices, not knowing what happened, or, you know.
My thinking level was diminished greatly.
Short-term memory was gone, all right?
My hands, to this day, still shake.
I went into depressed mode, and I still do.
I wake up every hour or 45 minutes. I do not sleep straight through no more.
I get scared when a door locks behind me. Elevators are a problem for me.
The subway train opens up, and a mass of humanity is all around you. Instant panic attack.
Post-traumatic stress disorder. When I was released from Marion, I was diagnosed with suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. I didn't know what that was. How can you come out functioning well when you have been remade? Your whole being has been rearranged into something that you don't even know who you are. You don't even know who you are anymore.
So what does this have to do with the rest of us who are not in prison, who don't have a child or a spouse in prison? We all have plenty of other problems to think about.
People, basically, they are concerned with, you know, trying to survive, everyday living that it takes to survive. So they will tell you, well, I'm not political. They don't realize that all of their life depends on politics, you know?
There's a practical way to look at the question of how this affects all of us personally.
Let me tell you something. Most of the prisoners in our country will come home one day. You got people going insane who are psychologically tortured and some even physically tortured. They gonna come to the street one day. And they might feel, you know what, it's time for me to pay the country back. This is the dangers of what's in the prisons.
Look, you have a dog in a cage, you keep hitting him with a stick, keep brutalizing him. Open the cage, let the dog run free. What's the dog going to do? Lick you? Wag his tail, or he's going to tear your leg off. This is the same thing with a human being. You take a human being and you dehumanize him, degrade him, emasculate him, disorientate the hell out of him, take him directly from DDU, and they do this, just dropping him into the community.
I know if the American people were educated as to what's going on in the prisons in our country, they would be up in arms that something be done.
Is this true, that America would be up in arms if we only knew? I'm not sure. In any case, I'm going to give the last word to someone who is up in arms.
My name is Teresa Vaughn. I am from Adrian, Michigan.
Teresa is not a survivor. She's a mother of a young man, Timothy Souders, who is also not a survivor. Tim did not survive solitary confinement.
Tim was a normal teenage boy who went into prison at the age of 19 for shoplifting.
Tim's story is almost impossible to believe, but it's been very well documented. In fact, there was a video camera monitoring his cell. Tim had bipolar disorder. And when he was arrested for stealing a toy from a 7-Eleven, he flipped out.
Tim was in a manic episode. he wasn't thinking clearly. And as he was leaving the stores, all the alarms went off. And then he started to run. And he had had a pocket knife on him. So when the police approached him, he was saying, "Kill me. I want you to kill me." And they charged him with felony resisting arrest.
They gave him a 3-year sentence. And then because he continued to act erratically, they locked him in solitary.
Tim was writing me letters home saying that some of these things were going on. And I didn't believe that it was as bad as he was saying, because I was just, you know, I never, as a middle-class American person, never thought that something like that could be going on inside the prisons. I really didn't believe that it was that bad until I saw the videotape. And it was 100 times worse than I could have ever imagined.
Tim died in solitary after being shackled to a concrete bed for 17 hours straight.
Tim was in there for 17 hours in 2-inch chains across his waist, his ankles, and his wrist, without anybody letting him up to use the bathroom, without anybody giving him water, without anybody coming into the room.
The cause of death was dehydration.
And the autopsy said that Tim died of dehydration with complications due to being restrained, accidental death. Only in the corrections department does somebody die an accidental death of being restrained. I mean, we would call it murder. Tim might be one of the survivors, being able to share his story to make a change, but instead, it's me. I'm the one that has to do this for him because he's not here with us.
Security threat group.
There's disciplinary isolation.
Keep lock.
Special housing.
CCR.
SA. La Solapa.
Supermax.
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 There's a whole pile of names that people use. I mean, it's just, you know what it is when you go there.
Survivors by Bay Area producer and teacher Claire Schoen, with original music by Kike Cruz. To read an interview with Claire, visit thirdcoastfestival.org. So one of the guys you heard in our last story, Robert King Wilkerson, who served 29 years in solitary confinement, features in our next story as well. I know it's odd, but his life is so intriguing that two different producers, completely independently, included him in their work. Against all odds, in solitary confinement, Wilkerson started cooking, and the food he made made everyone's life a little sweeter. Producers Nikki Silva and Davia Nelson, a.k.a. the Kitchen Sisters, first heard about him through a hotline they set up when they were working on a series of stories about hidden kitchens.
Message 24 was received at 1:20 p.m. July 6th.
My name is Arissa Arendt. I live in New Orleans. I have a friend who created the most amazing kitchen. His name is Robert King Wilkerson. He was in prison at Angola State Penitentiary for 31 years. 29 of those years, he was in solitary confinement. He started a chapter of the Black Panther Party with two of his friends. They've sort of become a cause célèbre known as the Angola Three. Somehow, in solitary confinement, he managed to create a kitchen, and he made pralines, which we love here in New Orleans. He's out now. They decided they had made a mistake for locking him up for so long. He had a new trial, and he sells his candies that he calls freelines, and they are really, really good.
I was fascinated with sugar. I used to watch Mama make candy with pecans and sugar and water, but it wasn't until some years later when I first went to prison, I was cooking in the kitchen. This guy was in the bakery. He could bake all kind of pastries, make all kind of candy. I was fascinated with the candy. What I saw before my eyes was like a science being revealed. My name is Robert King Wilkerson. We used to get milk practically every day, or butter, margarine. It wasn't really butter. and sugar. They would put it on your tray whether you drank coffee or not. So I used to get the guys to save the sugar. Sometime I was fortunate enough to get pecans. They got a lot of pecan trees around Angola. And they had some officers, once they taste the candy, making sure I had pecans. We would bribe the orderly. Sometimes you'd get a fruit can, peach can. But most of the time it was Coke cans. They were easy to get. Just peel the top. And then peel another can, triple it up, maybe 18 inches long, and have toilet paper, roll it up, and turn it into like a burner. It might take a day or two, maybe three, but it'll harden. I was definitely hidden. I couldn't let them know I was really doing it. They would come in, conduct a shakedown, and get the pot, get the can and everything else, and then write you up. I kind of enjoyed the thrill of going outside the box a little bit, making candy, and then giving it away, you know. Especially guys on death row, because I just wanted them to have something that they hadn't had in a long time.
Good afternoon. This is KLSP 91.7 FM on your radio dial. And we broadcast daily from the Louisiana State Penitentiary at Angola. I'd like to take this opportunity to wish all of the brothers up on death row a very beautiful day. And I tell you what.
King was released in 2001. On the very first day he's released, he's making candy. He was sitting there just stirring, stirring real slowly. Sugar candy. Freelines is what he calls them.
I call them freelines. I mean, I wanted them to rhyme with pralines. When I first got out, I went in the French Quarters and I went through every candy shop and I thought I could do better. Having, I guess, perfected a candy while I was in prison.
And he uses it for a fundraiser, political organizing events. A lot of times he'll bring some candy.
My name is Ann Harkness. I'm an activist and I have been King's pecan supplier. It's pretty much since he got out of prison. Everywhere he goes, he'll just bust out in some candy making.
My name is Malik Rahim, co-founder of Common Ground Relief and resident of New Orleans and the community of Algiers. King and I was raised together. His backyard was adjacent to my backyard.
They had a lot of fruit trees when there wasn't a lot of food at home, you know, like berries. Pecan, peaches, it was sustainable, you know. It had a variety of good things that nature provided free.
Freelance is something that you're doing to subsidize his income. That's the only option that really he had is by making candy. On his wrapper is not just no logo of King, it's Free to Angola 3, about his two comrades that is still incarcerated. He always looked at that injustice. You know, his kitchen will reflect it.
Submerged in water, 10 to 12 feet deep at least. It is full of debris. It is some of the dirtiest toxic soup you can imagine.
Reporting in New Orleans, I'm Yenty.
It was a few days before Katrina. I had made a batch of candy. That was the last time. I could have went to the Superdome, but there was no place to keep a dog. Can you? It's the name of my dog. I got her when she fit in the palm of my hand, you know. So I elected to hold tight. There were some people who came by in boats. We exchanged food. I gave most of the candy away. There were dogs screaming who had been locked up in houses. My neighbor next door had to break in the house. But I sealed it back up. I had to go in there and feed her dogs. She had two of them, and I had to fight them to feed them. You know, and I had been in the water twice to save two birds whose wings had gotten wet. I was hearing about so much death and devastation that were going on around me. I felt imperative that I save a life. I think I cried more in those 14 to 16 days that I was in the house after Katrina than I did in 31 years I did in prison. It not only took so much away from me as an individual, it replicated this hundreds of thousands of times. I think candy is a collateral. My doing what I'm doing, keeping focus on the plight of my two comrades who remain in prison. If doing so by cooking, making candy, open up kitchen, can produce money to aid them, so be it. Maybe that's my calling.
That was King's Candy by the Kitchen Sisters. To hear more stories of kitchens hidden away in unlikely places, visit thirdcoastfestival.org. ReSound is a production of the Third Coast International Audio Festival in Chicago. I'm Gwen Maxey. The program is produced by Katie Mingle and curated by Johanna Zorn and Julie Shapiro of the Third Coast Festival. You can hear today's program at thirdcoastfestival.org, where you can also hear hundreds of outstanding documentaries from around the world, and subscribe to our podcast. Support for ReSound comes from Dojo, a full-service digital agency, on the web at doejo.com. Dojo, we fuel ideas that grow. ReSound is also supported by Emma, a web-based email marketing and communication service helping businesses and nonprofits manage their email campaigns and online surveys in style. More at myemma.com. The Third Coast International Audio Festival is a nonprofit arts organization made possible with lead funding from the Richard H. Driehaus Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. Additional support is provided by the Agadino Foundation and the Menaki Foundation. The Third Coast International Audio Festival is supported in part by a grant from the Illinois Arts Council, a state agency. Special thanks to our many individual contributors from Chicago and around the world. If you want to contact us, we would love to hear from you. Email us at resound@thirdcoastfestival.org. ReSound returns next week with more radio that you can't hear anywhere else unless you live everywhere else.
You've been listening to the Third Coast Podcast. Stay connected with us through Facebook and Twitter, or by signing up for our email list at thirdcoastfestival.org. If you like what you heard today, consider writing us a review on iTunes or sending us a few bucks. As always, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.